Hi, I'm Robert Osborne. Thanks so much for joining me for TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, a chance for you to listen to complete conversations from our TCM archives that I've done with guests for our private screenings interviews. When we tape these private screening shows, I usually sit down with a guest and talk for about a couple of hours, but out of that, only an hour or less makes it to the air. So Private Screenings Uncut is a chance for you to hear the entire conversation uncut. Now, of all the private screenings interviews I've done, this next one was by far the toughest. The reason for that can be summed up with three words: Big Bad Bob, as in Mitchum. Many times before doing this interview, I'd met Robert Mitchum at screenings, banquets, social events, even presented an award to him at one function. He was always very chatty and a lot of fun to be around. A terrific raconteur, in fact. But the day of the interview, he was also fine. A bit grumpy at times because he was having problems with emphysema, but basically very fine until the interview started. The minute the camera rolled, Bob clammed up. He stonewalled me. Whereas he'd been chatting freely earlier, once the interview started, he gave me one and two word answers. I mean, thank heavens for Jane Russell. She joined us that day. Whereas he would speak a word or two and then clam up, Jane was very sweet and funny and trying her best to contribute, but always not wanting to take over the focus of the interview. There's no one nicer, you know, than Jane Russell. Bob, though, gruff. As you'll hear, as the interview goes on, Jane helps me pull some of his more interesting stories out of him, and they certainly both had a great many stories to tell, not only about the two films they made together, but also about the mutual people they worked with, such as Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, Howard Hughes, and Vincent Price. They also share recollections about some of the more difficult people they encountered while making films, like directors Joseph von Sternberg and Otto Preminger. Each also talk about their least favorite aspect of a show business career. Big Bad Bob definitely put me through the ringer with this one, but I think you'll find what they have to say quite revealing and enjoyable. So here, originally recorded in April of 1996, a year before Bob Mitchum passed away, and presented to you now, complete as it happened that day. Here's TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell.
Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell, you have been friends for a long, long time. You've made two pictures together. You've been through a lot of things and share a lot of memories. Do you remember distinctly when you first met? The first actual meeting?
Well, he says he saw me at the beach.
That's right.
And I had a dirty bathing suit on.
That's right.
What Galloping. It was one of those puckered suits, and when you went in the water, the sand all got into the puckers, and then when it dried, it was all white, sparkly, you know. And he says, I saw you in a dirty suit down at the beach. That's where I first saw you.
That's right.
But this was not a meeting. This was a stakeout, as it were. Do you remember when you were first introduced? Was that when you did your first picture together?
Yes.
I don't remember.
No, I don't either.
We had talked on the phone and talked to Reva, his secretary, and, you know, we just suddenly were on the set together.
When you were working together and got to know each other, was there kind of an instant rapport between you, or did it take a while to get to know each other?
We were very comfortable with each other immediately.
Yeah. So you don't actually remember your first impressions then of each other?
I don't.
You made two films back-to-back, His Kind of Woman and Macau, pretty much back-to-back. Yeah. Anyway, were those fun sets to be on once you got to know each other and felt comfortable with each other?
Yeah, pretty much.
The first set was a beautiful thing. They had this enormous stage, and they had put the swimming pool and built the hotel all around the edge of it, and it was... you thought you were there.
It was the first new set, totally, that we had built since the war.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the opening shot was a waitress, a little Oriental waitress, walking down the length of the bar carrying a tray on her derriere. That was it. John Farrell was his signature.
Kind of known as a difficult director to us today. Was he to work with?
He was a sadist.
Was he?
Yeah.
He was very nice to us, but he would be nasty to some of the other kids.
The people lower on the totem pole?
Yeah. And it was kind of needling all the time. And if if you needled him back, it was okay. But if you didn't think you could do that, you know, other people were kind of terrified.
So this is on His Kind of Woman. Then on Macau, you had Joseph von Sternberg. You had a couple of dandies to work with.
Really?
Now, what was he like? Because he, of course, was so famous for the old Dietrich films and had sort of had his day, I believe, by the time he did Macau, perhaps.
Well, he played the, you know, great foreign director. His name was Joe Stern. He was in Weehawken, New Jersey, truth to tell. Mm-hmm. We had a cameraman, Harry Wilde, who in a fit of, he'd get upset and throw his hat down and jump on it. Or he'd kick an apple box, you know. One day, he kicked the apple box, and Joe von Sternberg went flat on the deck. He was standing on it, and Harry kicked it out from under him. Joe von Sternberg was about that high, you know. But finally, when the film was finished, I kept meeting myself and going through doors. You couldn't cut it together. So,
Before that even, he would go to me and say something about Mitch, and then he would go to Mitch and say something, this beautiful girl, this beautiful stupid girl, what are we going to do with her?
Things, you know, like that,
it was kind of divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. And so finally, and he would have no food and no drink on the set.
No coffee.
Not even
for Cokes a specific reason?
Not Cokes or anything. Well, it was just
control.
Control.
Exactly.
And so finally, one day, and he was very nasty to the crew. And so one day, Mitch came in with a big blanket, and he just laid it out and put a basket on top of it, and out came the...
We had lunch.
The booze or the whatever and the sandwiches and the cookies, and he's passing them out, you know. And von Sternberg went over to him and he said, do you want to get fired? And Mitch said, no, you'll get fired. And he won.
They couldn't cut the picture together. So finally, Mr. Hughes said, I think somebody told Howard that it would take, they needed about 3 days' work. Well, you know, you can't really figure that out ahead of time. So Jane and Nick Ray came up to me with a big sort of legal pad and several pencils, and he said,
write it.
Yeah.
Put it together.
So I'd go in the dressing room and write, and then they'd send in the morning, and they'd get a secretary to type it up. And we shoot it in the afternoon.
A scene or two.
Yeah. And so you actually wrote some of the script then, too. You actually wrote some of the script then.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd still be there.
The best scenes are the ones he wrote.
Can you specifically remember some of the scenes?
No, I cannot.
Okay. It's the one one of them is where the two of us have a fight and I end up throwing something and it hits the mirror and breaks and he ducks. Where we acted like natural people.
Now, supposedly, at the time, there was a plan to co-star the two of you in a lot of films, kind of like Bogart and McCall, that sort of stuff. Were you ever aware of any other projects that were planned but didn't come about?
No.
Mm-mm. It's a team that Luella Parsons called the hottest combination ever put on the screen. So... So we know what a good combination it was. It's too bad that you didn't work together more. Did you have the same basic crews on your sets at RKO when
Pretty
you were?
Pretty much, yes.
You know, RKO is a studio that we don't hear that much about, certainly not in comparison to MGM and Fox and the others. So
RKO was a small studio.
But turned out some of the best movies, some of the best movies that endure today.
RKO. And the crews were the same ones. It was like being... your home away from home, really.
It was like a club.
Mm-hmm. We all
Everybody
knew each
knew
other very
else.
Well. We'd all congregate in his dressing room after shooting or something, you know, and sit around on the floor and tell stories and laugh and giggle. And
on the high-priced scripts, you know, like Cary Grant, you know, those were all contracted out, you know, the big agents and big movie stars. And we had to merchandise the dress.
They pull some old thing off the shelf and say, well, can't we make something out of this?
See, every time they'd make a deal with somebody that cost them a lot of money, along with it would come a script. They'd toss that in for $50,000, $75,000. So the studio would have to amortize it, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd say, we got to be here at 8 o'clock Monday morning. You know.
Now, you had a lot of experience at RKO before Howard Hughes took over there, when you were working and making some pictures. Yeah. Did it change drastically when Hughes was there? I mean, was it different? Because we don't really, except for the time that Howard Hughes ran RKO, I don't think most of us have a clear image in our mind of any one person heading RKO for a long period of time anyway. There was kind of the Pandro Berman period and the Schaefer period and others, but there was no one man like Louis B. Mayer at MGM or Zanuck at Fox that one thinks of. So I was wondering if it changed greatly when Hughes came in.
Only in the attitudes of a lot of the executives, you know, that at the studio, they were walking around on eggshells.
Do you think of that as a happy period, the RKO period?
Yeah, we had a ball.
Yes, indeed.
Now, you've both worked at so many of the other studios, and I'd like to get into just a little bit about how those studios, the personalities of them, what was like 20th Century Fox to work at as opposed to RKO?
It was a bigger studio. And
not as friendly?
Not what?
As friendly?
Well, you didn't know everyone, you know. They had a lot of activity going on, usually. And of course, that was Zanuck, you know, the ultimate. And it was they were very, not cost conscious, I should say, efficiency conscious.
Yeah.
And Paramount, what was Paramount like to work
with? Well, at Fox, I took my own crew with me.
From RKO?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I had my own crew with me, and they all knew somebody else in the makeup department or the, you know. So it was very friendly when I went over, but we'd scare them to death because the makeup man that both of us used half the time was Shotgun Britton, and he had a very
Shotgun Britton?
Yep, he was a Texan, and he was a golfer, and he wore yellow pants and a purple shirt and a green hat on the side, and he had the biggest Texas accent. Nobody could understand him. Oh, madam, what? What are some of his sayings? And he'd rattle them off, and people would come over and say, what did he say? You know, and I'd put my head out the door and say, shut! Get out of here! And he'd, oh, madam, I'm coming. It was our own joke, and everybody'd look, and they'd think, my God, she's a bitch.
Now, you both worked at Republic at one point, too.
I
think, Montana Bell there, and you did Red Pony. Although RKO eventually bought Montana Bell and released it, but it was made at Republic, I believe, wasn't
it? They bought it and stuck it out underneath something and hoped nobody would notice. Me, too.
And you did Red Pony there. Yeah. Was that during the Herbert Yates period at Republic?
For,
yeah.
And what was he like? Did you have dealings with him?
I don't think I ever met the man.
I never met Zanuck, either. And Paramount, did you work at Paramount?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good lot.
I forget what it was I did there.
Well, El Dorado, for one. I mean, maybe it wasn't shot at Paramount, but it was a Paramount release.
No, it was shot in Arizona.
That's when they were doing a lot of location.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you both worked at Universal.
Yeah,
you didn't,
I did.
Did you work on the lot?
Yeah.
And you did Foxfire there. Was that a... Because that was kind of a friendly little lot at one point.
Yeah.
But did they have varying personalities, those lots, or did they all were they all pretty much one soundstage was like any other once you got on it?
I think so, unless you actually knew everybody as we did at RKO, you know. But it was, they were all very efficient.
And Robert, you worked at MGM, and we always hear about that as kind of the Rolls Royce or Cadillac of movie studios. Was it? And you start, I mean, you were there also, not only as a star, but also kind of when you were beginning your career with Undercurrent and human comedy and all that. Was that as we hear it was?
Well, they had a caste system. You know, unless you did not speak to, you know, if you were stock under a stock contract, you didn't address Miss Garson or, you know, things like that.
Oh, Lord.
Really?
Is that even when you're co-starring with her in a movie?
Oh, no, no, of course not, no.
So that's when you're doing
supporting. I called her Big Red.
Big Red?
Yeah. My stand-in hung that name on her. And they had her marks on the deck, you know. He just took a chalk and wrote Big Red. She said, Big Red. And that was it. No, I was, you know, pretty independent. And
now, you had a run-in with Katharine Hepburn, I understand it. Or at least she had some words for you.
That is not true.
That's not true? Okay.
No. The only thing, I forget who was the cameraman. And I'm sitting at the piano. And Kate comes in a wheelchair, I believe. And she starts changing all the lights, you know. And then she says, Mr. Mitchum, darling, don't let them muck you about like that. She was changing for my benefit, you know. That's
because there was always the story that started, I don't know where it started, about the fact that she'd come in and said that you were, you know, such a good-looking guy and just a piece of meat.
Believe me, I would have remembered that. Believe me.
He'd have had a dandy remark, too. So.
And didn't you write a fan letter to Katharine Hepburn once? We're told
yes.
One of your only fan letters you ever wrote?
I was, it's when Little Women came out, so I must have been maybe 14, and that's the only fan letter I ever wrote. And of course, she didn't, my mother said, well, don't be disappointed, dear, if you don't get an answer. And I didn't. I invited her out to ride horseback in the country, away from the mob.
She might have liked that, as a
yes, she probably would have.
Did you ever meet her?
No, I never did.
I want to talk a little about socializing in Hollywood, particularly in the 40s and 50s. Was that required a lot to socialize with,
not to
get
me.
Your name in the magazines? Did they try to get you to do that?
No.
No.
So that wasn't a part of the... Did you socialize a lot? I mean, with each other or in your own...
No, you raised the owner.
Mitch was living in... what's the canyon?
Mandeville.
Mandeville Canyon. And there were about five other people that lived in the canyon.
Dick Widmark.
Widmark and your writer buddy and Dick Powell and...
Yeah.
And
Bob Taylor
June
lived there for a time.
And Bob Taylor. And so they kind of all got together once in a while over there in Mandeville Canyon, which is the way it is in Santa Barbara now.
Mm-hmm.
You just happen to be neighbors, and so you all get together.
But did you see each other a lot off the lot, the two of you?
Not a great deal.
Was it easy to get to make friends with people on the studio lot, or is that something that you just kind of worked with people? And I mean, your own circle of friends, were they a lot of people you'd worked with? Or?
Yeah.
Or civilians?
My crew were very good friends of mine, and I still see them to this day.
Yeah, that's...
Still get phone calls.
I think Jane and I were both, you know, oriented toward the crew, largely.
It's so interesting. You're both such independent people. You're both such big stars, and your paths were so different. You were like almost an overnight star, so publicized. At the early part of your career, before people even saw you in a movie. I think it was 5 years after the public started getting to know you that they saw you in Young Widow, the first film they really had a chance to see you in.
Young Widow should have died with her husband, and that story would never need be told.
What was kind of the turning point for you when you went from being this very publicized person to being like really accepted as an actress or in the motion picture
probably
community?
Probably Paleface, the son of Paleface.
And was that because of also the association Bob Hope?
I'm sure. I had a ball over there. Had a wonderful time. The producer was a nut and Bob was a doll to work with, and you know, we had a great time.
And you know, by contrast, did I believe like 27 films before you really, I mean, you really worked your way up the ladder with, in a lot of Hopalong Cassidy, I think 7 Hopalong Cassidys, and even a Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
And your turning point being the story of G.I. Joe.
Probably. Yeah.
Pretty much. Whatever happened to that movie? We never get a chance to see that. Do you have any idea why?
I don't know. Bill Wellman's son, young Bill, recently been trying to get, I think, a copy of it for, it's somehow hung up in Lester Cowan's estate. I don't know what it is. It's some sort of dog in the manger attitude that was developed.
That was the first one I remember.
Yeah.
Seeing him in.
And
it
an
was
Academy
wonderful.
Award nomination. Yeah,
great.
Wonderful movie.
Yeah. But I voted for Jimmy Dunn.
You did. Yeah. Were either of you ambitious? I mean, did you consider yourself ambitious as
very lazy me.
No. I would have done all those things that you mentioned had I been ambitious. You know.
Would you have been happier doing something other than acting?
No.
No, I don't think so. I enjoyed what I was doing, but there are a lot of other things I would like to do too. Decorate, you know, and design, and I love singing, so I liked working in clubs. This one should have been writing.
Well, I was
going to
say,
time.
You know, you said that you did some writing on Macau. I know you did some writing for Noel Coward early in your career, and you've always written for yourself, if not for somebody else. Was that ever an option of something you thought you might do?
Very distant option. It's a very lonely job.
He likes telling the stories out, and if the airwaves were all on the page, it would be marvelous.
No, it's a. It's too damn demanding, and it's, you know, too. There's no guarantee of reward. At least in the movies, you've got a union, you know. You know that you put in your time, you're going to get paid.
Did you ever think about directing?
Yeah, but A, you got to be there before the actors get there. B, you got to sit in a dark room and watch it all every evening. Now you got to sit in a dark room forever and snip, 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 and cut it up later for that shot, man.
Now you both had some experience producing. I know you produced The Wonderful Country, and you produced 4 films, I believe, with Russ Field.
Yeah.
Didn't you? I think that was your production company, wasn't it?
I don't remember. Probably.
But was that ever an option that you thought of doing more?
Not really, no.
To have that control?
I think the studios were kind of breaking up and the independents were just getting started. And it was something everybody did at the moment. But it's a lot of work. And you have a lot of trouble casting. Because everybody you want is already in something else, you know, and then you start.
All for a white chair with your name on it.
Yeah.
Another thing that's interesting, I think, is the publicity machines that were in the studios, and you certainly both had your share of publicity. Did you ever resent the intrusion of publicity in your life?
I did. I was. Well, I'll tell my story, and then he can tell his.
No, I don't know. It's it comes with it, I guess. I don't know if it would be better if they told the truth. It probably wouldn't be as exciting, you know. What happens is, one person concocts a story. The next one comes along, believes it, eats it up, discharges it, and the next one comes along, and it just goes on and on and on like that till it becomes true, because it's been around for so long. They invent, you know, stories.
They used to have people paid to invent those things.
Huh?
They used to have people paid to invent those
things in
studios.
Yeah.
But you never resented that so much.
One time I did. Yeah. I took the company to court and put them out of business.
Yeah.
Could you tell us what that was?
They had a story that I had appeared nude at a party, splashed in ketchup. I came as a hamburger.
And who were they that wrote the story?
A thing called, what was it called? Confidential.
Right? Uh-huh.
Confidential.
Sued them. One of them jumped off a building. The other one went to Russia. The something that might be of value to, you know, people today in the same circumstances. They passed in Congress. They took away their franking privileges. They couldn't send this thing through the mail. So that effectively put them out of business.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we were all thrilled. Because we, some way or another, we just thought, well, you have to take this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you can do about it. And then Carol Burnett sued, and you did.
Yeah. Maureen O'Hara, I think, sued as well.
Yeah. Oh, we were all just clapping.
And Jane, how about you? You said that you did resent it to a degree.
Well, actually, I'd started out modeling, so as far as just doing the picture side of it, you know, it was fine. I had to do publicity stuff every day, and it was just like I went right on modeling. And I got along with the photographers, and that was fine. But sometimes when we went out on location with the Outlaw, for instance, the photographer that I had worked with was a gentleman, and if he had a bad shot, he tore it up. And these guys were using any and everything they could possibly get. And they would get up on a balcony and try to shoot down. They were all trying to get, you know, bust shots and everything. And I hadn't, when I first saw this stuff, it was all over the magazines. And I wasn't aware of the kinds of shots they could get. So from then on, they had a bad time with me. Because I just, they'd say, lean over and pick up the pail, honey. And I'd say, up yours, buddy. You know.
How did your family feel about that?
They didn't like it. My mother, you know.
Did they understand it?
Oh, yeah. Because they knew me. But unfortunately, a lot of it was the fact that it got so much to do. Along came kids like Jane Mansfield, and it was like that was the thing to do, you mm-hmm. know, get it out there. Pull the clothes off. And I resented that a lot.
Robert? You had so much publicity surrounding you when you had the pot bust back in 1948, which actually made a lot of people aware of you that hadn't been aware of you, and actually, in a way, kind of enhanced your career. But it did, you know, for a while it looked like it was going to do damage. Does it ever, does the irony of it at all strike you that people can get away with so much, actors today, and there's not a bat of an eye about that?
I think the only thing that really, you know, sort of occurred to me or just disturbed me a bit was that it was thrown out and completely expunged from the record when it was proved that the whole thing was set up, you know. And they never published that.
No.
Mr. Hughes was going to fight it to the end, and he...
But that's not as colorful a story, I guess.
Of course not. No, it was resubmitted on transcript, thrown out of court, and expunged from the record.
Well, that brings up something, too, about the press. The press today gets a bum rap, and deservedly so, because of the way they hound people and do everything. Was it always that way? Or, I mean, was the press always sort of unreliable, do you think? Or more reliable than
well,
now?
Well, there are various areas of the press. For instance, there was a columnist in Hollywood, and he would do a lot of nightclubbing and things like that. And he would bum rap your joint if you didn't take care of him, you know.
which certainly still goes on today to extent, yeah.
I don't really know, you know, because it's, I can recall incidents of other persons, you know, who were very unfairly treated.
Yeah.
Certainly Ingrid Bergman, for one. I mean,
but that was an international, you know.
Tell us a little about Luella and Hedda. We hear about them as absolute vipers today. I mean, were they as bad as we're told today, do you think?
They were pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Fiddler and Sheila Graham, I guess they were all, in their day, had some power.
But it was really Hedda and Luella. And they didn't particularly like each other. No. There was a lot of jealousy going on. When I first met Hedda, she said, and I liked her, so I really got along with her. But she said, well, you're a perfectly normal looking girl. I mean, you're not, what are they talking about? I thought that was pretty cute. And Luella, one time, we had a waif ball, and both Luella and Hedda were invited. Waif was for adoption, and it was the first one they'd had. And Vincent Price had a cocktail party before and had invited Hedda. And so that she was at the same table we were at, and Luella was over at another table. And I had to leave halfway through to catch a plane to go to New York. So I went over to Vincent, who was sitting near Hedda, and I said goodnight because he'd been my host. And I got up and left. And Luella got the picture that I had gone to say goodnight to Hedda, and I hadn't said goodnight to her. And she was furious. So I thought, well, this can't be. So when I came back, I went to Luella's house, and I had tried to call her, and she wouldn't answer. So I went to her house, and they said, well, she was busy and couldn't see me that afternoon. And I said, well, that's fine. I'll just sit right here and wait until I do. And so finally, she came down the stairs, and I got to explain to her. And she was very nice, and from then on, it was okay. But I'm sure I never would have been mentioned again, or it would have been, you know, if I was mentioned, it would be all bad.
Did either of you have either of them take out after you in print?
Hmm. Luella tried to be accurate, you know.
Yeah.
She really tried as much as she could. Hedda was a little fussy, you know. But they both had great influence. Luella, I think, in particular, because she was the, you know, Hearst.
So she was a good newspaper woman.
Pretty much, yeah. She goes back to, as you know, a very rare incident.
The Charlie Chaplin?
No. Well, the Thomas Ince.
Yes, on the boat. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, could you explain that a little?
Huh?
Could you explain that for those that don't know?
I would rather not.
Okay. Anyway, an incident in which she was supposedly present at when a shooting on a boat happened,
right.
And a director named Thomas Ince was killed.
Yes.
And she kept quiet about the incident and everything. And that
had a job for life.
Yes. And Mr. Hearst was on the boat at the same time, and because she didn't write about it or say anything, she had a job for life with the Hearst papers.
Yes, sir.
But she did come from that old school where reporting was something, there was a certain journalistic code in which people did try to be accurate.
She tried to be fair, too, you know. Unless it was someone that her bosses, you know, were particularly slanted against.
Mm-hmm. Any roles that either, you said you weren't ambitious, but were there any roles that either of you wanted and didn't get or that you went after and didn't get? There's a story, one that I believe you wrote about in your autobiography about that you would like to have done I'll Cry Tomorrow, and there was some talk about you doing
it. Yeah, the gal that had written I'll Cry Tomorrow had suggested me, or, you know, said she was hoping I could do that. And at the same time, oh, I'll never remember the name of it.
Love Me or Leave Me.
Love Me or Leave Me was being made, and I was offered that, and I turned it down because I wanted to do I'll Cry Tomorrow, and then I never got to do I'll Cry Tomorrow.
Any other parts you think of that you really wanted?
Not particularly.
Any that you turned down you wished that you would have
done
that?
We didn't get to turn many down. At RKO, you kind of did whatever they put in front of you. And if the script needed fixing, why, you hoped it could get fixed.
Did you resent that at all? I mean, or did you feel like, as an employee, that's what an employee did?
Yeah. It was par for the course.
Yeah.
Because that's a whole different mindset than actors seem to have today, when they go in, actors are in such control. And
agents are in control today. Mm-hmm. So the agent and the star and the poor stars have to pay for the publicity people, for the manager, for the this, for the that, for the other, and we had all that.
Mm-hmm.
It was handed to us. It's one of the reasons I think they have to get so much money today. They've got so many people on their payroll. It's mm-hmm. terrible.
Now, you turned down Patton, I understand.
Yeah.
Do you remember why?
Yes. They had they were shooting it in Spain, and they had all that leftover World War artillery and so forth. You know. And I had met I think it was one guy, it was a George Patton's nephew, wrote a book called Before the Colors Fade, and another chap who was in the CIA, whom I knew, who was connected with Patton. And I read this book, and Patton was a really an extraordinary man. Really, you know, prescient. He said he was buried right there. You know, he knew he lived some of the ancient battles of Europe. And I thought, actually, they'll go over to Spain, Marbella. They'll just clank all that hardware back and forth in front of the camera and charge the stockholders $14 million and completely walk away from the story of Patton. And I am so studio-oriented, I'll say, well, you know, so what else is new? And I said, they should really get somebody who actually fights for the character. So I suggested they get George C. Scott, which they did, and for which I'm very glad. And I'm sure he's pleased. And he did fight for it.
Mm-hmm. How about Dirty Harry? That was another one that
before. I'll give you a list of the people who were offered that. Frank Sinatra, Bill Cosby, and me. Neither of us, none of us wanted to do a violent film at that time. And I'm not sorry about that, you know.
Did you ever get close to doing Streetcar Named Desire? That seems like such a
no.
logical part for you to play sometimes.
No, when I got the script, I was under contract, and the studio said we could probably spare you for about 4 months. That includes rehearsal time, everything. Well,
this was to do it in New York.
Do it in New York, yeah. So that was the end of that.
Because that's a great Mitchum part.
It's a great anybody part, really, you know.
Does it, Jane, you said you weren't ambitious, but you know, we are living in this double standard society where fellows like Robert Mitchum can keep working and go on forever. The guys, that's not quite allowed to the women. Does that ever rankle at all?
That doesn't rankle me, because I go in the kitchen and can't remember what I went in there for. And this one could look at 5 pages of dialogue and read it through once and know all the words. And I had to study. I hated him.
Do you like to work?
Yeah, I enjoy working, and as long as I could, like this, fine. I can make it up as I go along, you know.
Now, you've had a lot of stage experience, done a lot of things on stage, in stock, and various theaters, and on Broadway in company. What was that experience like? You went into company after Elaine Stritch, after it was already kind of an established hit,
yeah,
but I think,
yeah,
believe did it for 6 months. What was that experience like on Broadway?
I did it for 6 months. It was, I was very nervous about learning plays, number one, but I would just go over it and over it and over it, and my kids would even help me and until I could, you know, it would just come naturally. But there was a opening on Broadway is spooky. And we
just
were,
because it's Broadway, that
I guess
that
so. And the first show we did was for all the actors in New York, which was absolutely terrifying.
And did you get to rehearse? Because as a replacement, you came in as a star and as a replacement. Did you get to rehearse with the first
company? We rehearsed about 2.5 weeks is all.
Because that's such an intricate show.
I know. And we thought we would never learn it. That was another reason it was scary.
Were there other new people coming in at the same time?
Half the cast. So we had an entire cast because they were going to split it, and Elaine was taking half of the kids on the road, and the other half were staying, and I was one of the ones staying in New York. So to learn an entire play in two weeks, you know, 2.5 weeks, dancing, singing, the whole thing is very, very tough. But once we had opened and we realized that we really did remember where we were supposed to go, which door to go through and which line to read coming out, you know, it was okay.
Does anything ever scare you?
Everything.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
I don't believe that quite.
No,
why don't
hard.
I believe that? I mean, you seem like such a in control, kind of laid back.
Well, I just go to sleep. It's my reaction.
You go to sleep?
Yeah, this too will pass, you know.
This too will pass. Dorothy can scare him.
No, you said it.
Dorothy can scare him.
Now, you once played, I know you did Duke Mantee in the Petrified Forest once, yeah. And you've done some stage work, but not really since you've established yourself as a star. Were you ever attracted to do that? To go in the theater, and why? Any particular reason? You must have had so many offers that it would boggle the mind to do plays.
Not really, no. The only difference is in the theater, you shave in the evening, and the pictures you shave in the morning. But no, I think the picture business is a lot easier, except on occasion, you know, for endless hours, you know, that happens. But no, I don't have any great hunger for the touch of the live audience, you know.
What about books that are out today? There's so many books and written by people, a lot of people who don't know the subjects or about the subjects. Books we have on, there's a new book on Howard Hughes, books on Marilyn Monroe, you know, books on you, both of you. How do you feel about those books and that? Do you read them? Do you keep tabs on them?
There's one book on me. The first paragraph has my name wrong. My birth date or birthplace and my wife's
off to
name.
A good start.
Anyway, there were five mistakes in the first paragraph, and it goes downhill from there. I never met the writer. But like I said, you know, they one eats it and spits it out, and the next one comes along, eats it. It's got to be true, you know. It's in print. But it gives them something to do, you know.
Did you read the books on people like Monroe? You both worked with her. And are they accurate from your...
I have no idea. I just glanced through, you know. I met Marilyn when I was working at Lockheed.
Really?
I was running a shaper and a drop hammer. My partner was a guy named Jim Doherty, married to a guy named Norma Jean Baker. And we went to the Lockheed dance, you know, things like that. So I'd known her, you know, for some time. Sweet, nice girl, mm-hmm. Really. and absolutely sexless. I mean, she didn't.
So after that, then you did River of No Return together, when you were both established stars.
Yeah. I had been up in Idaho, and there was a very strange incident that happened up there. There was a guy taking his bride down the River of No Return, and they camped alongside at night, and some maniac came down, hauled her away, and ate her. Some cannibal. And they tracked him down, of course, and they found a few bones, and they whacked him out. He escaped from an institution. So I came back and I told this guy, I forget, Stanley Rubin, I guess. Next thing I know, I said, what is this? They said, your story. I never forget, I came out, had a meeting at the 20th with Zanuck and Howard. And I said, what the hell is... And Howard just turns to Darryl, he said, see, Darryl, I told you, it's a misunderstanding. So that was it. So I wound up in the picture with Marilyn.
But they didn't eat her. It was they didn't eat her.
Oh, no.
And you found her. We know your long friendship with her. I mean, your good, close friendship with her.
She was a darling girl, you know. Yeah, she was. Very kind to everybody, completely devoted, unfortunately, to everybody, you know. And they abused her. And she suffered from what now is called agoraphobia. She'd go and have her hair done when she had lived on Doheny, you know.
Yeah.
And she'd go to had a hairdresser up on Sunset Boulevard. And she'd come back to her apartment, and it would seize her. She'd be frightened to go out.
But they didn't know what that was then.
No, they thought she was being difficult.
Mm-hmm.
She had agoraphobia.
Do you think she'd be surprised or pleased that she's this kind of international symbol of Hollywood of the 40s and 50s now? I mean, you go anywhere in the world and they have a picture of Marilyn and she's sort of
I don't know. I don't know because she was always burlesquing herself, you know. I mean, she just, you know, aped the image.
Do you think if we knew her as you both knew her, we'd be as fascinated by her as we seem
to be
today?
I'm sure, because she was a very worthy person.
You're a very sweet little girl.
Yep.
She was getting afraid to go out on the set with the gentlemen and her makeup man told my makeup man, they were both buddies, and he says, Marilyn comes in an hour and a half before Jane does, and she's all ready. He said, she just is afraid to go out there on the set. So I would go by the dressing room and just say, come on, baby, we got 10 minutes to get over there, and she'd go, oh, okay, and she'd get up and we'd trot on over. But it was to walk out that door by herself and go, she just... And she didn't know as many people on the picture as I did because I had my own crew. And I'd made a lot of pictures by then, and she hadn't. I think it was her first dressing room on the lot. She'd made a picture or two before that, but she didn't have her own dressing room even.
So actually, if that had been diagnosed and they don't mourn about that, she might have been able to be helped way back, because I think, wasn't she ultimately fired from Fox?
Well, they'd sit on the set and be mad, you know. They'd sit there and just be furious instead of going and helping.
If we knew Howard Hughes as you both were able to know him, would we be as fascinated by him as we are today?
I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Howard was neat. He was.
Has he gotten a bum rap, you think? Stories about
you
him?
You bet.
Oh, yeah. You've got to remember, he had Ginger Rogers out on a skeet range one time, and she couldn't follow, she couldn't track the target. So he went to his engineers and he said, we better design something that shoots around corners, that follows the target, the Redstone missile, all those things up there flying around Howard Hughes.
So it was a genius about all
oh,
that.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He was a genius, and when you met him, he was a very sweet man, very quiet, and he would ask you, you know, please, will you do so and so? It wasn't like he wasn't the authoritarian
no,
they've made him out to be at all.
Well, aren't we finding out now? I believe that he had some disease as well, or something connected to something that had happened to him in one of his accidents, or something that caused him to some chemical imbalance, or something that. That caused him to be perhaps more eccentric as he went
on. I know that when he dumped the airplane in Beverly Hills, when he was in the hospital, they couldn't give him an aspirin. He would have no, you know, pain relievers or nothing. And he redesigned the propellers, bought the company, Hamilton Propeller Company. And
he redesigned the bed.
And the wheelchair,
made
which is
it
the
so
one that they use now.
You could push a button and it would go up and down instead of somebody grinding away.
Kept himself busy.
Jane, he directed your first film. How was he as a director?
Thanks a lot. He was very polite and very sweet, but I don't think he really knew what he wanted, or he didn't know how to tell you what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So you did it over and over and over.
He just liked to watch, I think.
Jack Butel would do it. He did the grave scene 103 times. He did not make mistakes. He just did it 103 times, you know. And Walter Houston, who was getting paid by the week, you know, was thrilled. Jack and I were getting $50 a week for the whole bloody mess, you know.
What would you say is the biggest...
It took 9 months to make.
Yeah.
Because he did it over and over. Then he'd look at it all night, you know, trying to pick the right... He was a perfectionist, and you don't do that with acting, you know. You lose all the spontaneity. Mm. Jack and I were going, don't raise your right... Say, Jack, that was just... It was very nice, but you raised your left eyebrow. If you... Would you do it again and don't raise you? So pretty soon it's like, you know, you don't
afraid
dare move anything.
Did Howard Hawks or somebody come in and finish that?
No. Hawks was supposed to do it.
And then Hughes
And
took
Hughes
over.
Was giving him his opinions over the phone, and Hawks finally says, Howard, why don't you direct the picture? And he got in his plane and flew home from... So then Howard decided, okay, I will try that, and it took us 9 months.
And then actually about, 6 or 7 years before it was released because of censorship and everything. It must amuse you today with what goes on the screen today, that the outlaw...
I couldn't see one thing wrong with anything we did in that picture. There was nothing that embarrassed me whatsoever. And the Marine officer, whichever one it was at the moment, would just... having a fit because you saw some cleavage or something when I went like this with the blanket. And Howard had made up his mind he just wasn't going to put up with that. So he kept it out, and he would put it out himself. And in the meantime, I'm doing publicity.
Mm-hmm. But it certainly fanned the flame for the the movie.
Yeah.
Because I remember when one finally got a chance to see it.
It finally made a lot of money.
Indeed.
But I wasn't very good in it.
What would you say was the main misconception that we have about Howard Hughes, if there is a misconception?
They paint him as this rude, kind of bossy, crazy man.
Conniving.
Mm-hmm. And he was not that.
He was not.
No.
He was a gentleman.
Tell you one thing, if he said it, that was it. It was his word.
Yeah, if he gave you his word, he kept it.
That was it.
Absolutely, you could count on him. And if you gave yours, he expected you to do the same.
Honor it.
Yep.
He was a very honorable man.
And if he saw that you were not doing that, he would cut you off, and that was the end of it, which he did with a number of people.
Did you stay in touch with him for a long time? I mean, up until his later days?
Not really. I never... when he would phone once in a while if there was something particular that he wanted. I think he talked to Bob more than he did to me, actually.
I talked to him just before he died. He called... Perry was down there in Mexico.
Ah. You
know, so he called me up. And he sounded, you know, wholesome and all right.
I want to bring up some other names, some of which you shared relationships with these people as directors or whatever, and some you didn't, but Raoul Walsh.
He was my father.
He was great.
They warned me, you don't want to work on that set. You know, he's a very difficult man. I fell in love with him. I absolutely adored him.
In what way? I mean, what particularly about him was...
Oh, he was very gruff and grumpy, and he would say exactly what he thought, but he was marshmallow inside, absolute marshmallow. Sweet man.
Yes, sir. He knew what he was doing, too.
Yep. He was old school, and he would roll his, you know, roll his own cigarettes. And
one
and
hand.
He had...
One hand on the blind side.
Yeah.
And they keep falling out.
He had a patch over one eye, which he lost his eye in an accident. And he would listen to the scene. He'd rehearse you. But then when the take was going, he would turn his back and be rolling his own. And he was listening. But I remember Richard Egan got very upset. He thought, that guy doesn't care at all. You know, he's not even watching. And it was Raoul was listening, because if he believed what he was hearing, that was more important than what he was seeing.
And maybe had a heightened sense because of the loss of the
possibly,
eye.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Howard Hawks, you worked with in El Dorado, and you worked with certainly on the beginning of The Outlaw and then Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. What was he like as a director?
He was a great gentleman.
Yeah.
Very efficient and... very direct. That's it, you know. He didn't waste any time or footage or any film.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Clark Gable, who you co-starred with in Tall Men, and then were the producer of The King and Four Queens that he starred.
He may have been the biggest tease that ever lived. He loved practical jokes, and he and Raoul got along just fantastically. They were rooming together in the same house. They had rented houses for us to stay in. And Raoul got a de-skunked skunk and left it in Gable's room. And when he walked in and saw this thing, he just went back up again, Raoul, screaming back against the wall, you know. But they just, he was just a tease. He loved practical jokes. Neat guy.
Vincent Price.
Wonderful. A real champion. A great gentleman.
Fantastic, and had such a sense of humor. It's not to be believed. He loved playing, you know, great sense of humor. And he was always playing those very stiff parts, but the minute it was over, it was fun, much funnier. He was a very erudite, he was a collector, he was a writer, he was a lecturer, he was a wonderful actor.
An art critic.
An art critic.
And a marvelous cook, a great chef.
Great chef. And one of the funnier people of all time. Great sense of humor.
Which never was really shown on screen very much, was it? His humor.
He got, when they did that, the retakes on His Kind of Woman, Vinny had got to play a character for the first time. You know, a real zany nut. And he enjoyed it immensely. It kind of had absolutely not too much to do with the original script, but...
I don't know how many directors we had on that.
Before John Farrow or during?
No, John Farrow
John
started.
John Farrow did it and finished it, and then they wanted extra.
I see.
We had done a complete, very good film, but they was so pleased with it, they were going to make a great film out of it, so they threw it another million, and the original budget, I think, was 750, something like that, which was, those days. But now they're going to make a great picture out of it, so they throw in another million and the kitchen sink and everything else.
Charles Laughton, who directed you in the only film he ever directed and one of the great films, Night of the Hunter, what was he like to work with?
Absolutely marvelous, because he was a great appreciator, and he responded to everything, mm-hmm. really.
And did he know his way around the camera, even though he'd never directed before?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, he had an excellent cameraman, and it's 90% of the job right there, is the cameraman.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, what's the biggest misconception we have about Frank Sinatra?
I have no clue. What is a misconception about Frank?
I don't know. Probably that he's Mr. Razzmatazz or something. He's a very nice man to meet and to be around.
I do not say anything because I'm expecting a card from him in a couple of weeks.
Expecting a card?
Every Mother's Day.
Oh, you get a card from someone?
I get a telegram or a card, yes.
Yeah, no, I think we think of him as a swinger, but also kind of a muscle man, a man that pushes people around and is a tough guy and is loyal to his friends, but somebody you wouldn't want to meet if you weren't his friend.
That's probably true. He probably will carry a grudge if he's mad at you for a long time.
He is Sicilian.
Now, you worked with him during a period when he wasn't really at his...
Yeah, he hadn't done the one wonderful...
From Here to Eternity.
He hadn't done From Here to Eternity yet. And he was getting his divorce, and he was just starting to date Ava. And it was a very difficult period for him. And that was the dumbest picture in the entire world they stuck us in.
Double Dynamite.
I was playing a... absolute ninny of a girl, and he was playing a ninny of a boy, and it was just dumb. We got to sing together, and we enjoyed that, but the rest of the picture was ridiculous. We had no business, either one of us, in it.
Groucho Marx was also in it?
Groucho was in it.
Tell us about Groucho.
Groucho is Groucho. He's just about like that all the time.
Was that a fun experience to work with him? I mean,
No, I hated the script, and Frank was very quiet, and it just passed, thank goodness.
David Lean, who directed you in Ryan's Daughter.
Sure did.
One of the great films.
Perfectionist.
Yeah, well, if you ask David, how his concept of the film, or what his attitude about a scene, be like asking at the beginning, asking Michelangelo what the ceiling is going to look like. David has a complete concept, and pursues it.
Was he a tough guy to work for?
No, not at all. I mean, he worked very hard. He wasn't picky, things like that.
Which brings up a location. That was a long location shoot.
11 months.
11 months. Would you prefer working on location as opposed to a soundstage where you're going home every night, basically in a...
Depends on the location, doesn't it? That wasn't too shabby. Dingle, Ireland.
Have there been a lot of bad locations you've been on?
Not too many, no. Toughest, I think, was Track of the Cat, working up on Mount Rainier, I believe. 30 feet of snow. They call lunch, and you take two steps up and three steps back. By the time you get there, lunch is over.
That was an interesting picture, particularly because of the color concept. As I recall, it was done in color, but all in black. Everything was black and white except a...
My jacket and the blood on the snow.
Yeah. Henry Hathaway.
Look out. The great the host, perfect gentleman, until he walks on that set.
Was not Otto Preminger the same way?
Oh, yeah, but Preminger, you know. Come on, unglued. Preminger was an actor, basically, you know. But Hathaway would scream and fire everybody. Chewing on a cigar.
You did two pictures with him. Was he the same way on both?
Yeah.
Pretty much?
Oh, yeah.
It was his style then.
Pay any attention to him, you know. Yeah, Dale Robertson was under contract at 20, so Hank had to use him in a picture. So Henry went over, he's seething, chewing on a cigar, and he said, listen, I'm a little nervous when I'm working, and I may call you a stupid Oklahoma son of a bitch, but I had to get it out, you know. Don't pay any attention, because 5 minutes later, I forgot the whole thing. And Dale said, well, that's perfectly all right, Mr. Hathaway. He said, you know, I was in the Army for 4 years, and I spent three of those years in combat, and I'm kind of goofy myself. So you feel perfectly free to say anything you wish. And if I should happen to step across and knock you flat off your ass, don't think a thing about it, because 5 minutes later, I forgot the whole thing. I can say word one to him. Dale would have done it in a New York minute, too, you know that.
You know that Dale and John Peebles have the same birthday exactly?
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Really?
John Peebles, your husband.
Yeah.
But...
I'll give you a picture of my husband, too.
Hank, you just, you know, he'd scream. But that was his style.
And he made good movies.
Yeah.
The Houstons, you worked with John Huston
yeah.
in one particularly terrific picture, Heaven Knows Mr. Yeah. Allison. What was he like to work with?
Marvelous.
Was he tough?
No.
The one great thing about John, he's behind that camera. You know, no matter what the scene is, no matter what he's been there.
Tell him about the Moore bit. More.
The only thing he ever said to me was, I think even more, Bob. I said, really, John? He said, I think even a little more. It's the only thing he ever said to me. And I knew exactly what he meant. We went back, shot it again, and I did it even more. And that was it. The only thing.
We're talking Houston's. What about Walter?
Oh, he was
on
a
the
love.
Outlaw.
He was a love. Sweet man. He was very helpful. Jack Dutel, you know, and I was our first picture. We didn't know what we were doing. And Walter would be very sweet and very helpful. Thomas Mitchell was there, and he got so frustrated with Howard that he finally would take off his hat and throw it down and stomp on it and scream and holler and yell. And Hughes is sitting back with his hat down on his head, looking at the toes of his shoes. And he looks up and he says, oh, did you say something, Tommy? And Tommy goes, and rocks away. Howard knew perfectly well he was losing his mind, but he was just going to play it cool. He didn't hear him.
Bob Hope.
Oh, he's just like he is. It's as much fun off the set as it is on. Very sweet. He never misses a trick. Very watchful. You know, and always got an answer. Even today at 93, he's got an answer.
Is he a driven man, would you say? He's still so active at 93.
He is one of the people that we were talking about earlier. He's a performer, and he wants to go on that stage. So did George Burns, you know. And Connie Haynes still singing out there, gotta do it. Some people are like that, and others are like us. They can go home and put their feet up, and whole world can go by.
Forget it.
Vincent Minnelli.
We're working back down in, where was it? Texas? Anyway, no, Mississippi. And he went over and started to sit down on a log, and I bulldogged him. He just almost sat on top of a copperhead snake. And the production manager back at the studio, whose name I hope I don't remember, just shut the picture down. And it had been too long. So Vincent Poor was in tears, he was running into trees, and came totally unglued. But Vincent, was like a decorator, A little dab here and a little dab there. And with that, the constant pursing of it,
I think that was his background, wasn't it?
As a
set designer, I think, at the Radio
Something
City
like
Music Hall.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he had certainly an eye for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I recall now that people said you could always recognize a Minnelli mm-hmm. set. Yeah.
Like a Mitchell License. Hmm? Mitchell License was the same way, because he had that, I think he came from the same art director background. Any directors you wouldn't work with again? I mean, if somebody said, we got this great script, but you just wouldn't want to deal with him again?
Ron Sternberg.
Not much chance of that. No, I can't think of anybody, their problem. I know.
Deborah Carr.
That's his favorite lady.
Yeah, she's a great lady.
Anything that particularly made her great as a lady to work with?
Well, we could have a sort of a telepathic continuum, and we're working together, and each one knows what the other was thinking. Comes out very well.
Was there an instant rapport with her when you first worked with her?
Yeah.
Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, was that the first one together?
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to read off some names for a purpose. Kath, these are all women you've worked with, besides Deborah Carr and Jane Russell. Katharine Hepburn, Greer Garson, Susan Hayward, Loretta Young, Myrna Loy, Ava Gardner, Rita Hayworth, Marilyn Monroe, Olivia de Havilland, Shirley MacLaine, Gene Simmons. Any that you missed that you really wanted to work with? Of the ladies?
No, I don't think so, no. No.
How about the guys? Any guys that you didn't get to work with that you really would have liked to have worked with in a film, either a director or a actor?
Me?
No, I was asking Jane.
I always wanted to work with Wild Bill Wellman or Willie Wilder. Never got to. A lot of things I didn't get to do.
Bill Wellman, you would enjoy.
Actors. Oh, I always wanted to work with Fred McMurray.
Yeah?
Yeah, long ago, when he was doing his comedy things, mm-hmm, I remember I went on the lot at Paramount. Somebody that was supposed to be an agent took me on the lot, and I met the casting man. This was way before I did anything, and they said, well, their actors were too short, and I was too tall, and I was dismissed, and I said, well, Fred McMurray isn't, He isn't short. But no, I never got to work with him.
Any directors you didn't work with,
aye,
Robert, that you would like to have? Because you hit, huh? You seem to have hit most of them.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. You find, by and in large measure, I should say, that directing, simply basic, not basically, but too often, it's a matter of ego. You know, I told him. That's why you find so many actors becoming directors. Mm.
You, I think, had the distinction of being in about the only film that was released without a director credit on it, and that was Desire Me. With
yeah,
I
nobody think desired anybody.
No one desired to take credit, certainly.
Started off, it was George Cukor. We had, who was the guy, with the English director was Boiled Egg Eyes. I forget how many. Mervyn LeRoy wound up at the end of it. Odd switch from Cukor to LeRoy. And I was working with Lorraine, was it? I believe. The Locket.
Lorraine Day?
Yeah, Lorraine Day. Mm-hmm.
The Locket. And working at night on the back lot of the 40 acres at RKO, Pathé. To be in makeup at Metro at 7 o'clock in the morning. Noon, they would fly me to Monterey to work with Greer Garson. I did that for 21 days and nights. Three pictures at once. 24, no time to sleep, nothing.
Wow.
You know what they did with Pearl Bailey? She was doing a show, nightclub in Las Vegas, and working in a picture in the daytime. And when she got through with the nightclub, she would get into the back of a hearse, and they drove her to the rest of the night while she slept, and then she'd go on the set.
And Preminger was the director.
Was he?
Yeah.
Incredible, but that's, you got to get your sleep somehow.
Yeah.
But you weren't getting any.
Why do you think no one took a credit on that film? Certainly there have been films that didn't turn out like everybody wanted it to. Yeah.
And you don't know?
Well, I don't think it's that bad, actually. It has one of the great music scores ever in a movie.
It comes from an old German melodrama called Karl und Anna. And we are to believe that there are two men, prisoners of war, and one of them is married and he talks endlessly about his wife. The other one escapes and goes back and convinces the woman that he is her husband. Now come, you swallow that?
He's heard so many stories about.
Yeah.
About her, he can say, I know, I remember this about you and that about you. And
they look entirely different.
Yes. It's odd.
Why did they ever think, do you think, that they thought they could pull it off or that Cukor would even start doing
okay,
it?
Okay, George Cukor, fine.
Victor Seville, was it?
No, he was came he? In. Yeah, Victor Seville came in. Zoe Akins, fine.
Who
Cukor
wrote it?
Cukor and Akins together. Pasadena, man. I had a line that is, then take her and go, or it might come over me that I'd sooner toss you both into the sea to be swept out like rocks by the tide than to see you standing there laughing at me, taking me for the fool that I am. I said, wait a minute. He said, this is a genius I bring you, this is brilliant. I said, wait a minute. Da Vinci, Botticelli, Cukor, Zucker. How do I know? He says, lousy reading. I said, I meant every damn word. He said, I know, but it was a lousy reading. You know. And he runs away. Now, with dialogue like that, Jack, believe me.
Jane, I wanted to ask you maybe some of your vivid memories of The French Line.
Well, that was the first and only time I ever walked off a set.
And why?
They They wanted me to wear a bikini in the dance number. And nobody but the bad girls in the south of France, the naughty girls in the south of France, were wearing bikinis. Nobody in the States. And I said, no, no, no way. Even the camera crew were saying, oh, no, oh, you know, you don't want to do that. So I went down to the beach and I stayed there until they had a new costume. Michael Wolff and Howard had to get together on the phone.
Which was fairly abbreviated as it was,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, he cut big holes out of it, but it was one piece. I said, it's going to be a one piece or else.
Now, as I recall, having seen the film in the theater, the shots they used in the theater are different from the ones we get in the edition shown on television now, because when we see the number looking for trouble on television now, it's kind of a long shot of most of the number. And as I recall, when it was in theater in 3D, it was very much a close-up number,
too.
Well,
it was both, yeah. Back and forth.
Didn't that run into some censorship problems, too, that film?
Oh, yeah.
At the time?
That was the time. It was after that nonsense that I said to Howard, I don't want to go through this anymore. I've been in two pictures now, and both of them, you've managed to, you know, have a fight with the censors or something. And so he promised me that I would never have to do that again. But he said, if you tell anybody, I'll deny it.
And was true to his word, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. He absolutely kept it.
Robert, Out of the Past, one of the great film noir thrillers of all time. What are your memories of that?
Well, it was, we shot it up in Bridgeport, California. We wrecked the plane coming in there, coming up to the location.
Wrecked the plane? How?
Plane crashed.
Oh.
And it's now classified as a film noir film. Fact was that the high-priced actors that are back on the studio, like Cary Grant, so they got all the lights, so ours was lit with cigarettes. And that was it.
You invented film noir because you couldn't afford lights, right?
We couldn't. We were on the bottom rung of the economic ladder.
Do you have any idea history was being made when you were making
that
film?
Not at all, no. No. No, Betty Jane and I enjoyed it, though, you know.
Jane Greer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We enjoyed that sort of counterplay in the dialogue.
Now, another one of the big location films you did was The Sundowners,
yeah,
which you did in Australia. What are your memories of that?
Well, it was, rather a pleasant exercise. We started off around Cooma, which is below Canberra, up in the Blue Mountain area, and worked in a little town called Nimitavelle, which no longer exists because they were building up the lake when the lake now is submerged this town. First day it rained, we had hail and sunshines and snow all at the same time in a tiny village. Then we moved down to Port Augusta in South Australia, and the day we arrived there, the wind was blowing off the Woomera Desert about 60 miles an hour, and the temperature was 114 degrees, and we went immediately to work, got off the plane and went straight out to the location.
Yeah.
And Freddie Zinnemann got hold of the loudhailer, and he said, I wish to make one thing absolutely clear, there will be no beer on this set. And the Aussie crew chief picked up his hailer and he said, there'll be no bloody crew either. And that was the end of that shot. But it was pleasant enough, you know, we had a good time.
Great script.
Yeah.
Great cast.
Yep, Peter Ustinov was fun, you know.
How do you feel about Academy Awards? You're one of the probably most neglected men in the Academy Awards because, and I have a theory about that, you've never been bad. So your good work has never maybe looked...
I'm a journeyman, but, you know.
But how do you feel about the Oscar process?
It's all right with me. We all gather together once a year and say nice things to each other and give each other medals. That's great. What the hell?
If we were giving you an Oscar right now for your best performance, which one would you pick it to be?
It's dwindling down because I got to think of the things, the ones that I've seen. I haven't a clue.
You don't have a favorite Robert Mitchum film?
No, I don't. I don't think so.
Do you have a favorite Robert Mitchum film, Jane?
There's a lot of them I haven't seen.
I don't pay to see him.
So are there a lot of...
I just like Robert Mitchum movies.
Are there a lot of Mitchum films you haven't seen?
I believe there are, yes.
And no interest after you've made a film and spent that time doing them to look at them?
No. They say that's a wrap. When I said, go cash the check.
I would just think that after spending as much time as one has to spend an energy on a film, that you'd be curious to see the film.
Nice. I suppose one would.
Do you watch new films today? Are you much interested in the films that are being made today?
My husband and I watch television film. We watch television every night. I don't go to the theater very much.
Can't find a place to park.
Do you think we're in an interesting time right now in the movie business? The films that are being made, the actors that we have, the work being done?
A lot of it I don't like. It's either very good today or it's terrible.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, some of the stuff
I think I've seen probably 4 pictures in the last 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. When you watch for the Academy Award, you know, it's just... Some of it is just so awful. You think, why are they even discussing it? And then suddenly there's a little jewel.
Are you both Academy voters?
Yeah. Dalton Trumbo said, though, he's talking about movies, and it's great for kids.
It's great for kids.
Yeah. He took a projector and chopped it up and threw it in the incinerator. But you're right about one thing, great for kids.
Now, I'm going to read a quote that you may know, maybe isn't a Robert Mitchum quote, but you said, any way you look at it, it's demeaning for a man of my age to work. Did you ever say that?
I may have. I don't know.
Do you feel
that
way?
So.
Huh? Do you feel that way?
Today I do, yeah.
And why?
I think I should be supported by devoted children.
You once announced, I think you were 52 years old, that you were going to retire, and I think that lasted 4 months.
I retire every morning.
Do you?
Yes. I think that's what I said.
Would you ever be happy retired?
Sure.
Could you be happy doing nothing? What would you do if you had all this free time?
You stare into space? Sob?
He reads.
And writes? Do you still write?
No. Checks.
It's a shame.
How do you like to spend your time, Jane?
Reading. I do. I read. I get in the chair and I read. I might go swimming. I might take a walk.
How would you best like to be remembered? First, by movie fans, and secondly, by your friends.
I'd like to be remembered by my friends. The rest of it doesn't really matter.
Is there a Jane Russell film that if we were going to put one in a capsule you would prefer to put in?
I like Fuzzy Pink Nightgown, but it wasn't in color. It's my mistake.
That's one you produced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I suppose the best one would be A Gentleman Prefer Blondes because it had Howard Hawks and Jack Cole and, you know, it's too bad.
Isn't your brother in that too, in one scene?
Yes. Yes, I have 4 brothers and one of them is in the Muscle Man thing. doing the handstand.
How would you like to be remembered?
Fondly.
I have a question that we ask of everybody that comes down. For we want to get your idea of movie heaven. Now, I know you're probably not great movie buffs or fans, either one of you, but what would your idea of movie heaven be?
I don't understand the question.
Well, if you love movies, would your idea of just having a heaven day with movies, would it be?
Have everyone that I watch be wonderful.
Yeah.
Instead of some of the junk you have to look at.
I stopped working at Epinay Sur Seine one time outside Paris. I stopped in at some other studio. And they were filming a real bacchanal, it must have been 200 people, all in various stages of nudity and doing things that, you know, you only heard about by the numbers. All over, one seething mass of flesh. And I said, what the hell are they going to release this? I said, oh, no, it's just private. Sort of. Some fellow was just producing it for himself, his own entertainment. I suppose that's your idea of movie heaven. You know.
God.
A cornucopia.
Jane, what's one last question. What's one thing that we don't know about Robert Mitchum that would surprise us?
That he's really an intellectual. That he really is well-read, I think that he knows as much as he knows. As wise as he is. I think maybe now they're getting the idea, but I think years ago they used to think he was Peck's bad boy, you know, or something.
Do you think it's something he deliberately tried to keep hidden?
No, he just isn't going to broadcast, you know. He's modest. He's unflappable.
Mr. Mitchum?
Until you have really done something that is so unfair that it isn't true. And then he'll lose his mind. But just pray that never happens. But 90% of the time, he's unflappable.
I would suspect he's a little like Mr. Hughes, too, that if you kept your word, you're okay.
Oh, yes.
And if you didn't.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
I find it, one does, but you find one would rather not get used to disappointment, you know.
Have you been disappointed a lot?
It wears out, you know. You don't expect too much.
Was this early Mitchum, though, or is this something you learned later in your life, or were you always kind of aware of that?
It's like the old story about the putting the kid up on top of the dresser and saying, "Go on, jump, I'll catch you." You know, I don't trust nobody. That's the best.
But were you always that way?
I've trusted everybody and I got dumped. You know, that's simple. But if we expect to get dumped, that's...
Can you still be disappointed?
Surely. I just don't have any, you know, high hopes for anything, anyone, or, you know, any solutions. Just take it as it comes.
Have you learned a lot from him?
I think so. I've known him so long.
She has the same philosophy. She just takes it one day at a time.
And have you always been kind of that way?
Have I always been what?
That way as well? Where you kind of learn to take a day at a time and where you're kind of wise about things?
Yes, but I don't think I'm, I don't think I've been disappointed as much. Maybe I expect more and demand it or something. I believe in the man upstairs and that he's arranging my life, and if I get out of line, he'll whap me one. And if I'm, the rest of the time, I am loved.
And that started very young. Hmm? That's always been a philosophy of yours,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Since you grew up.
Yeah. We were all raised that way. The Lord was your best friend. Your dad, you'd climb up on his lap.
Did it ever bother you that people seemed to find that a strange dichotomy, this girl who had a very strong religious philosophy and everything, as opposed to this kind of hot sex symbol image?
But that hot sex symbol image is all the publicity machine.
But did it ever bother you that people confused the two?
Well, that's their problem. We thought the other was a joke.
Robert, what is it about Jane Russell that we don't know that would surprise us, do you think?
Oh, dear, let me go out of the room.
Uh-huh. She is, I think, is totally honest. Which is, I'm sure, is not a very well understood description, but she is absolutely, totally, flat out honest. Honest and true. What you see is what you get.
Actually, that doesn't surprise me, because no. I think it's what we've all responded to in Jane Russell for years on the screen. I think we know she's an honest, and with you too, that you know you're getting the real thing. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
You're very good.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.